I've found it fascinating. I've met people that I never have normally met. I've met Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara. I've met Admiral Kidd, Admiral McDonald. I've met Itzhak Rabin, Chief of Israel Air Force, who was involved in 1967. It's been very, very interesting. I started out with an open mind to find out what I could find out. In fact, one of the first persons I contacted was a gentleman named Jim Ennis, who was wounded aboard the ship, and he wrote a book on the subject. And unfortunately, I was unable to have a response from him as to part of his position, but I have talked to other of the crew members. Some of them are here today. Are they here? Oh, there they are. Okay. There are some members that agree with my conclusions. There are others that disagree. I'm not here to convince or lobby the crew members. I'm going to share everything I found with them. I'm going to accept any evidence they want to send to me to consider, and there's going to be a revision of the book, because when the book was in progress and it was printed, I still had a Freedom of Information Act request pending with the National Security Agency, and I had published in the book as Appendix 2 the transcript of the Israel Air Force that was made that day, which covered the period before, during, and after the attack. And for years, many people published articles, made statements that the National Security Agency had tapes that supposedly proved the attack was a deliberate attack, that on the tapes you would hear the voices of the pilots describing it as a before and during the attack as a U.S. ship, and going ahead and attacking it anyhow. Well, on July the 2nd of last year, the National Security Agency kindly agreed to my FOIA request and released their audio tapes, which were made in an EC-121 aircraft operating in the area. And those tapes are on the web. I believe the site is NSA.gov. They're also on my website, thelibertyincident.com. You can actually hear the Hebrew tapes. You can see the translations. You can see the message that was sent from the NSA to the President of the White House on the 22nd of June. That's all there. And what I find most interesting is that although they haven't covered the earlier part of the Israeli tapes, initially when I published the tapes from the Israel Airport, people said, oh, well, you know, you can't trust them. They probably just made them up. But the tapes that the NSA had, if you take them and compare them against the Israeli tapes, they dovetail. In the Israeli tapes, they report that the first time that an Israeli helicopter pilot saw a U.S. flag on the ship was at 3:12 in the afternoon, about 44 minutes after the attack. And that's what's on the NSA tapes. They hear the Israeli helicopter pilots recording the flying at 3:12 in the afternoon. Another remarkable thing happened 2 days ago at the conference at the State Department. They released their documents for the 57 war, and included is the CIA intelligence memorandum from June 21, 1967. I've been trying to get that through the Freedom of Information Act for some time, so far without success. But lo and behold, there it is handed to me. Nobody seems to have noticed it or read it on Monday. But, you know, the book is that thick. It's a big, fat book. But I certainly intend to include that in the revised edition of the book when it comes out, because it definitely and clearly states the position of the CIA on the 21st of June, which at that point they determined that the attack was not made in malice toward the United States or in fact in the States. But I spent 16 years, not full time, as I say, I did a daytime job, but on and off throughout the 16 years, are gathering what I believe is the largest collection of material on this subject in the world. I met the skipper of the Liberty, Bill McGonigal, in 1991, right up the road here in Washington, or down the road in Washington, D.C., and we remained in contact, and we had developed a closer and closer relationship. Initially, he wasn't talking about the Liberty, but eventually he opened up and we did talk about it. In fact, I had even arranged a conference call where he, I, and the CIA chief of station talked at length. And John Haddon, the station chief, who was in Washington Monday and who joined my paper, which I filed with the State Department, and that's a very interesting comment when the state publishes that very shortly. I commend you to read what John Haddon, our chief covert intelligence gatherer in Tel Aviv in 1967, and Herman Castle, USA Watch essay there at the time, our chief covert intelligence gatherer. They both joined my paper, and they have some very interesting material, which I wish just telling you about any little bit of it would take all of the time I have. 16 years just won't fit into the 30 minutes allocated, and in particular, we want to leave a little bit of time for questions. So I would point out, however, that I'm sure you've all seen the beautiful memorial display out there on the wall, and in honor of the Liberty members. As a matter of fact, I have the same picture of Captain McGonigal in my book, and I have his Medal of Honor citation reproduced in the book. And for those of you who do read the book, there are chapters that attempt to cover in detail many of the questions which, as I say, have asked, that couldn't be answered in 30 minutes. They can't even be answered in a half an hour, in a half a day or a day. From the point of view, however, of the National Security Agency, I'll just share with you a little bit of my research that started when I learned that the NSA actually had these tapes. Now, I had interviewed Clark Clifford, the president's special advisor and chairman of the president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. And at the time, he told me that he had not had staff for his investigation, but they used the Department of Defense, and that he had, based on certain electronically, and the terms I think he used were electronically recorded material, he was convinced that it was a mistake. Let me say this. If you read the Clifford report, he was mad as hell. I mean, he uses very, very strong language, and some people say, have accused me of being an apologist for the Israelis. I'm not an apologist for the Israelis. I'm a United States naval officer with 38 years of service and 19 years of service in the federal judiciary. I've reported the facts as I've seen them. The Israelis made many blunders for which they are at fault, but the evidence that I found does not indicate that what they did was an intentional evil, malicious act, just as the CIA came to the conclusion. It was not done with malice. It was negligent, perhaps it was gross negligence, but the same also applies. There were blunders on the U.S. side, and you can see that kind of the paper I filed with the CIA, with the State Department, is focused solely on the topic of the intelligence blunders of both the United States and Israel, but cataloged with recommendations that we should learn from them for the future. But nevertheless, lo and behold, I had thought that Clark Clifford had heard the Israeli tape, but I didn't know about the NSA tape when he reached his conclusion, which is published, and he came to the conclusion all the evidence indicates it was a mistake. But then out comes this startling information. The NSA had tapes. And a man named Bamford wrote a book in which he quoted Marvin Nowicki, at that time the chief petty officer who was a Hebrew linguist. Incidentally, in 1967, the NSA called them special Arabic language, because they didn't want the Israelis to know that they were training people to listen in on them. But in any event, there were very few of them. He was one of them. And he and a second Hebrew linguist aboard the aircraft had made these recordings and sent them back here or across the street behind that big fence, and where they were analyzed by a third Hebrew linguist. And Stanford said Nowicki told him that the tape proved the attack was deliberate. When Nowicki heard that, he was less than pleased, wrote a letter to the Wall Street Journal, which I distributed Monday at the State Department, and if we have time, I'd be happy to pull out a couple copies of that letter of Nowicki, saying to the editor of the Wall Street Journal, "You got it all wrong. I told Stanford the opposite of what he printed in his book." But nevertheless, no matter what was that what Nowicki said, Nowicki said also, "The truth will never be known unless those tapes are released, and I'm sure they've been lost by now." Well, he was wrong. They weren't lost by now. They were released on July 2nd, as I said. Listen to them, read the translations of them on the internet. But from the point of view of the NSA was doing listening, and although everybody likes to call the Liberty a spy ship, in my opinion, it wasn't a spy ship. It was an overt intelligence gatherer. It had every right to be on the high seas and to listen to what people were transmitting in the open. I mean, broadcasting in the open. So, spy ship, intelligence director, yes. Spy ship, not my term, but it's sexier from the point of view of the publisher. And so now you'll see spy ship on the cover of the book. I didn't want it there, but there it is. In any event, through the wiki, I was able to get in touch with his third Hebrew linguist, and he told me an interesting tale. He told me that he had been on the Valdez, which was another overt listener like the Liberty, which had come up from the Indian Ocean through the Suez Canal, made a turn up all the way into the corner of the Med, and then came down the coast of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, and then on out, and ultimately through the Straits of Gibraltar on its way back to the United States. And he, this third Hebrew linguist, had served on the ship with a gentleman named Al Blue. Al Blue was an NSA Arabic linguist. They had been shipmates for, I don't remember the number of months, but many months on that voyage. And they got back to the United States, and about the time they got back to the United States, the crisis was heating up in the Middle East, and a decision that was made by the NSA or the Joint Chiefs, I'm not sure who had the final word, to send a listener to the coast of the Sinai for a purpose which became overcome by events when the war started, and the Liberty was ordered to leave Abidjan, Ivory Coast, sail for the road to Spain, pick up some Arabic and Russian linguists, and sail over to a point off Port Said, Egypt, and the Sinai. And that's what was happening. Al Blue, having just returned, was ordered to fly over to Rota, Spain, and get on the Liberty. The third Hebrew linguist was requested, but he pointed out that he was due to get out of the Navy in June, and there wasn't time for him to go on another cruise. And so, he didn't go, and there was no Hebrew English on the Liberty. And he sent me an email, which I would like to read to you, because it's on page 137 of my book. The author received an email from the third NSA Hebrew English dated October 11, 2001, that stated in part, "Al Blue, the NSA Arabic linguist, was a friend of mine. We were both on the Valdez during the February to April of 1967, having picked up the ship in Nassau, Ethiopia, and rowed it up the canal into the Mediterranean and out to Barcelona. When we returned, they told us we had to go right back out to get on the Liberty. I told them I was due to be discharged from the Navy in June of 67, and it was unlikely the Navy would let me go. With so little time left, so they agreed that I couldn't go, which resulted in no Hebrew English aboard the Liberty. But they said that Al Blue had to go. So because of the fact that I lost a good friend in Al, and of course, Naval Security Group, detachment, shipmates, and other wounded civilians, I was ready to blame the Israelis, along with everyone else who was angry. But, based on what I heard, both from eyewitnesses and the tapes, my conclusion has always been that it was a case of mistaken identity. I tried to get this gentleman to come out, but they do such a good job indoctrinating people on the security aspects of the functions of the NSA that he is still not willing to be named publicly. And I invited him to come to the State Department meeting, and I don't know if he came or not, because I said, if you don't want to come out, just come and sit in. Maybe he was there, maybe he wasn't. But basically, what I'm telling you is that there is a lot of evidence out there now. I believe with the disclosure of this NSA material in July, the CIA material that came out on Monday of this week, there are only two other potentially significant items. One is a code name security report of a House committee which is locked up in the safe of the House Appropriations Committee. That committee did a study of the, not at large, but a slight study of the Liberty matter, and that's still classified, and I don't know how to get my hands on it. And the other item, there's one other FOIA request I have pending with the National Security Agency for another document, which would, I think, not send any new light, but just substantiate the things that I found so far. As I say, if anyone has any evidence that they think I should consider, send it to me. I will certainly consider it, and if it is evidentiary in nature and bears on anything, I'll be happy to include it in the revised edition when it comes out. I wish I had another 3 or 4 days to talk to you about all the things I've done over 16 years, but I'm down now to 7 minutes before the security people come and escort me out to the sidewalk. So why don't we take that time for questions, if anyone would like to...
I have a question. You're talking about the helicopter policy, early helicopter policy, and you're talking about evidentiary value. What evidentiary value is there to their conversation if they arrived after the assault they didn't participate in it?
Well, the point is that the message is you are ordered to go out to this point to pick up survivors. This is a search and rescue mission. Mm-hmm. Pick up survivors from an Egyptian ship that has just been attacked. That's what they're called to do. Then, as the situation developed, as a matter of fact, there was really quite a bit of excitement in the world that day, because it wasn't just one monolithic situation, it was changing constantly. The Air Force had already determined and stopped the air attack because they saw the Roman markings on the ship and knew that this was an Arab ship. And the Air Force controller at 2:14 said, leave her. And they go back to headquarters. They're wondering, who is this ship? And at that time, this is a blunder. I attribute one of the first blunders of the Israelis was in 1956 when they moved Air Force headquarters from Ramla to the main headquarters in the Kerry and Tel Aviv, then up to Navy 60, 65 miles away in Haifa, and communicating by telephone. And so the Air Force is trying to call the Navy and say, we've got some doubt about the identification. And the Navy is coming out there, and they stop and they're signaling the ship, who are you? And tragically, and you can read it on the placard out there, that's when the Liberty started shooting at them. And that kind of settles things, I think, in time of war as to whether you're opposing a friend or a foe.
How do you explain, Judge? You said there was no malice involved. How do you explain the machine gunning of the lifeboat? Isn't that a war crime under any circumstances?
Well, sir, that's an interesting point. It's one of the myths that has grown up, that the testimony of Lloyd Painter, and I commend you to read the Court of Inquiry report. It contains 155 pages of sworn testimony from survivors. And in there is the testimony of Lloyd Painter. And 4 or 5 days after the attack, he is telling under oath the Court of Inquiry that life rafts were damaged by machine gun fire from the airplane. And then, 10 years later, he remembered that life rafts were being shot at by the boat. And then later still is a story that they evolved from life rafts to lifeboats, and then they were lifeboats full of people. The story has developed over the years, but no one else who was on the bridge who was involved in the eyeball view of what happened that day made any mention of that. And memory changed with time, and I don't want to pick a fight with Lloyd Painter, but that's the source of that story, and I think it's not accurate. Yes?
I was part of the hearing on Monday, and I was very upset that the testimony of the survivors was totally chopped off. And I would think that the survivors would have the ultimate information to give.
The survivors certainly know as much or more than anyone else about some of the things that happened that day. If you are in an automobile, and if you drive into an intersection, a car smashes into you, you know that you drove through the intersection, that you had the right of way, and that you were smashed into, and maybe your arm was broken. But as far as the car that smashed into you, you don't know if that driver was in a rush to get to a meeting, whether he or she didn't see the stop sign, whether they were drunk. The facts about whether or not it was an intentional or a negligent or other act that brought that car into you, that is a matter that is not known to the victim. But no one disputes what the victim said. All I'm saying is that any of the victims has any additional information, send it to me.
To answer your question, the State Department put out a call for papers. It was on the internet. It was sent out to their mailing list. Anyone who wanted to present a paper or position was welcome to do so. The State Department, as I recall, and since Secretary Judge come along on this, accepted every proposal that was sent in with one exception, which is not a So it was just an open forum to anyone who wanted to participate. On the internet, and as I say, mailers, they sent out mailings, they got two different ones from the State Department. But anyone who wanted to write a paper or make a presentation, they had a right to do it, was invited to do so.
But
and it was a professional magazine.
Okay, but the people who got up to talk,
the
that's the
issue.
But
they had
the
client
didn't ask the question when
they
had information to give.
This wasn't designed to give information, man. This was a presentation of papers by the members of the panel who had submitted papers and were then asked to come and present them. And at the end, the program called for, at the end of the presentation of the 5 papers, then there was commentary from a moderator, a professor Smith from Arizona, who commented on the 5 different papers that were presented, one by the CIA, one by the National Security Agency, the historian, and others. And then there was a discussion of the scholars. They had about 27 professors and historians and government officials from all over the world that were sitting in this center, and then the procedure that was outlined in the program was that those people would comment, and then they would ask, they had 2 microphones, and I said, if anyone has a question, you may present a question. Several people got up and began making speeches, and I'm sorry that they wasn't, I'd like to talk to you for the rest of the afternoon. Maybe I can answer some of your questions if you have any, but you see, we're out of time. The program was supposed to end at noon. The speeches can be made until about 5 or 6 minutes after noon, at which time the moderator said, I'm sorry, we're out of time. Closed the program because they had to move on. So the next panel will be on time. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Why did Al Blue lift the pocket out
here? He was a civilian employee of the NSA, not a Navy person. Yeah, he was a civilian. Well, I mean, he was, but the NSA compartment was staffed by a Navy, I guess you'd call it a Navy security group, but they were the tenants aboard the host ship, the Liberty. The ship's crew ran the ship. They ran the NSA compartment. Only I could be wrong on this, but as far as I know, only the captain, Captain McGonigal, and the executive officer, Commander Armstrong, had authority to even go in that compartment on the ship. And they had a certain direct communication back here that didn't go through the regulating system, and there were, I believe, three civilian NSA employees, a gentleman named Blaylock, who was wounded but survived, and I believe Stavney had passed on some time ago, and then there was a third NSA employee whose name is on the plaque, but I don't remember. I don't think he was wounded. I think he survived, but he's still alive. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering about the credibility at all of anything that you would see from James Bamford. In Body of Secrets, he brings up a subject called Code Name Operation Northwood. And you have to look at the book to see it, page 82. The concept is bizarre that the Joint Chiefs had a plot to go towards Cuba. And the way Bamford expressed it, I said, let me find out something about Operation Northwood. I went onto the web.
Well, probably, I don't mean to cut you off, sir, but I happen to agree with you that I don't think that Bamford is a particularly reliable source. And if you read my paper, which the editor with the department is about to print, I cite specifically a series of inaccurate reports that she made. For example, the report was missed, and the Wiki contradicted. He said he got it wrong. And the NSA was quoted in the Baltimore Times on, I believe, the 21st of April, 2002, but that information is available, saying that the NSA seldom makes press releases, but what Mr. Bamford said yesterday about the NSA is simply not true. I mean, so I agree with you.
One point I would like to make. When you go onto the web to find Operation Northwood, you find all of the conspiracy crazies listed, and some of these sites would turn your stomach.
Well, there's no question that people in the United States love conspiracy, people that would like to tell you that the Earth is flat, that we never sent a man to the moon, people from outer space come in in flying saucers, and who killed Diana, JFK assassination theory. America loves that, but unfortunately, it's a free country. If you want to have a conspiracy theory, you're welcome.
In your book, you mentioned that you didn't think General Diane ordered this attack on the Liberty. Who do you think did?
Well, I mean,
from the Israeli point of view, who ordered the attack on the Liberty?
If you read the book, I mean, it's not just who ordered the attack, it was a sequence of events.
Mm-hmm.
On the 7th of June, there was a report from the United States Defense Act that day, Colonel Anthony Perna sent back to Washington, said there's a report that the Israelis in the Sinai near Al Arish were being shelled by the sea from an Egyptian ship on the 7th of June. On the 8th of June, at about 10:30 in the morning, the Israelis owned the ground, they owned the air, and explosions are occurring. If you'll read about them in the Liberty log, the log itself, they're sailing off the shore reporting the TV's explosions in Al Arish. And the Army reports to headquarters were being shelled from the sea like yesterday. Now, that happened to be wrong. They weren't being shelled from the sea. It was some Egyptian people behind their lines blowing up some stuff. But they passed the message to the Navy, investigate. The Navy comes, sends down an order for torpedo boats to where the Liberty, tragically, some events they just sit in place terribly. The Liberty is sailing along the coast of the Sinai. It's a gray ship, 14 miles out. The way you can see is, you know, it's a gray warship color, and you can't tell much more about it than that from the land. And it's heading 283 degrees. It's got its bow on Port Said. The Navy starts approaching. They make another mistake. They figure it's going too fast. They can't catch it. And of course, their mindset is it's an Egyptian destroyer because that's who they're fighting, the Egyptians. The Egyptians had Scorpion-class destroyers and Z-class destroyers. And who else could be bombarding from the sea? And who else could be making high speed? So they call back to headquarters and say, we can't achieve the target. We need air. Now, if you knew the situation between the Israeli Air Force and the Israeli Navy, and I go into that in the book. I wish I could tell you the whole story, but there was a terrible rivalry there. The young fellow who was on the motor torpedo boat, so maybe I'll just take an extra minute and tell you that the story he tells, I put it in the book, because he points out that on the first day of the war, the Israelis sent out their naval commandos to, I think, 5 Egyptian ports. In Alexandria, it was a disaster. Some were captured, some were killed. Up in the north, at the port of Latakia, they put their people in, their mission totally failed, and this Dormotus Obedo was division, 914, was set up to extract them. And they picked them up and got them out safely. But in the milling around, one boat hit another, made a hole about that big in one of the boats. Took it back to Ashdod, down in the south, repaired it within 10 or 12 hours, and now this motor torpedo boat division is zooming down towards where a ship is reported killing their troops. And as he says, here we are on the fourth day of the war. The Air Force had destroyed all the Arab Air Forces in 80 minutes. The paratroopers had captured Jerusalem, the Western Wall, and the West Bank. The armor had zoomed across the Sinai, and the infantry was about to dip their feet in the Suez Canal. And the Navy, we'd made a hole in one of our own boats. We were anxious to get into the action. So there, in some of the documents that you'll read, they're discussing whether the carbon trigger happy is correct or not, but there's no question. One, the Navy, if they could have gotten there first, they would never have called the Air Force, in my opinion. But the Air Force gets the message. The Navy's chasing a target. There's a lot of details, and that's a very complicated matter, too. There's a lot of other interesting stories about it and what created mindset. But nevertheless, the Air Force, they felt used by the Navy the night before on a mission that was a false mission. There were no targets they were sent out for, and they said, well, we're not sending planes to you. Tell us you got a target. So the Navy said, okay, we've got a target. So then they ordered a flight. They were coming back from combat air patrol over the Suez Canal. And said, on your way home, which is, in fact, that was the way home, you know, it's an elbow there, and the planes would fly across that elbow. And the Liberty saw many planes flying back and forth. And just as, from their perception, the world around us, many of the Liberty people were home. All those planes are there looking at us. I mean, there were many planes on many other missions. But in any event, these people were told, go to El Arish. There's an enemy ship there. If you find that enemy warship, hit it. But be careful, we've got 3 ships in the area. So the plane went over with that much authority, and even so, he found the ships, he sorted them out, he called back to headquarters, he talked to make sure that the 3 ships were the Israeli ships, and then when he was sure that he wasn't attacking his own ships, which incidentally, in that 67 war, the Israeli forces attacked their own forces 18 times, in addition to this tragic incident. But then he began his attack. 12, 14 minutes into the attack, as I mentioned, they called it off and developed the doubts about the identification. So who gave the order? It was sort of at a tactical level, right, very operational level. Of course, the initial approval for the target was approved by the chief of the Air Force. That sent some planes over. And then it fell to the chief air controller. The chief of the Air Force was Mordecai Hodge. I mentioned him in the conclusion of my paper, which I hope you'll read in the State Department. He passed it over to Shmuel Kislev, who was the chief air controller, the second air controller. And I mean, it's hard to say this was a lucky day, but if anybody had any luck that day, it was that Kislev took over from his deputy. The deputy said, I've got to fight him. 4 Mirage 3Cs armed with iron bombs heading south. The bomb sand sites along the canal. And shall I send them to this target? Now, you all probably recall the Battle of Midway. With iron bombs, the United States Navy sent 3 Japanese battleship aircraft carriers in 10 minutes. The fourth went down the following day. That's what iron bombs do to the ship. But Kissler said, no, it's more important that you attack the sand site. You have somebody coming home to the organization. They found the flight that was running low on fuel and ready to go home and sent them over. And they were armed only with 30 caliber machine guns and a few A-9 missiles, as I understand it. The second flight that they called in from attacking armor in the Sinai was armed with 30 millimeter cannons. The supermissaires, the guys that came in, were also armed with 30 millimeter cannons, and each had two napalm canisters. Not the stuff you send out to send the ship. And so, as I say, if they had any luck that day, it was that they didn't get attacked by iron bombs, so it would have been a much worse tragedy than the terrible thing that happened as it was. I don't know how much more time I have. One more question.
I would like to ask you if during your investigation you came across anything that came from here, an allegation made in one of the Russian sources that came across recently, that Liberty sent a resident party to the shore to install some street equipment from the Russian shore.
I've never heard that allegation. I'd be happy to, if someone can send it to me, I'd be happy to research it out. I do know that in Liberty's log, at about 12:45 in the morning after Liberty had sailed away and was heading initially toward to the bay and ultimately diverted to Malta where the court of inquiry was held, that Liberty logged that they passed a Russian merchant ship in the night. And they couldn't positively identify it, but they believed its name was Rybolovska. I think the translation I got was Proletariat in English. I can't pronounce the Russian. And from that has grown stories that a Soviet destroyer came up to Liberty, offered help, and said, "We'll stand by with you for until you more help arrives." And that story identifies, I believe, it's a Russian frigate number 626. The problem with that story is that Russian frigate, 626, is reported being alongside the 6th Fleet off of Crete on the day that the event occurred. And if that ship had got there at the time that it's reported to have come and offered help, it would have probably had a sailing about 120 knots, which destroyers don't do. So that ship was there, but the Davis and the Matthews got there at 6 in the morning. And even if they left all at the same time, they wouldn't have got there much before 6 in the morning. And so I have nothing that indicates that there's any substance to that story. I'd like to... Mr. Cram. Mr. Cram is a survivor of the Liberty crew.
One of the complaints of many of the crew members is when we came off that ship, we could not talk. And it went for years until then I was going to book. At that time, we started to get together. Nobody seems to want to talk to us. Nobody wants to take, our...
So, I didn't want to talk to anyone from the crew. In spite of some popular announcements, I actually have some friends in the Liberty crew. Not everyone there disagrees with me. Some people totally agree with me. Others violently disagree with me and think I'm an enemy. I'm not the crew's enemy. I tried to be an amateur historian and call whatever they thought. I'm going to talk to any crew member who wants to talk to me. I'm going to receive any piece of evidence. But normally, Jim Ennis's pitch is, I'll march 50 people out there, 50 crew members who will swear that the attack was intentional. Well, that's the conclusion. I asked Ennis initially, and he's never answered that letter. What evidence supports that conclusion? Tell Jim to send me some evidence.
You just talked about ships of planes flying back and forth. Yeah, there were a lot of planes flying back and forth. But I can tell you there were planes that flew masthead height over that ship two or three times. I saw those planes. You could almost see the guys in the cockpit. We waved them, and I believe they waved up. Well, there was reconnaissance for that ship.
Well, that is a whole detailed series of blunders. There is no question that they have identified it at 5:55 in the morning as an American ship. They even identified it by name later in the morning. That information got to Haifa, where it was down the hall from the command and control room in naval intelligence. A wedge was put on the board identifying the Liberty. At 11 a.m., Commander Remy Abraham Luke ordered it off the board. He was brought before a court of inquiry on that question. Why did you do that? His answer was, by the time I ordered it off, the information was 5 hours old. The ship was reported on a heading of 123 degrees, 70 miles west of Gaza, doing 15 knots. Ships don't stay still, and I thought it was proper to take it off the board. In my research in Israel now, I find that in their computer system, once they put something on the board, it can't come off. The computer won't allow anything on the board to come off. But that's good hindsight, but mistakes were made. They made some terrible mistakes. The examining judge issued a report going detailing all the facts, and that report was sent to CNO, and a personal copy was delivered by Ambassador of Rome to the number two man in the State Department, Nicholas Katzenbach. He read the report in Rome's presence, and he said, "It's really an excellent report, except for the last sentence." And the last sentence said that in consideration of the foregoing, in time of war and the circumstances, careless, perhaps, not to have done a better job in identification, that it doesn't rise to the level of criminal act for which there should be a court-martial. When, in 1995, you may recall, we shot down with our F-15 two Black Hawk helicopters in the Iraq no-fly zone. It was a clear day. They each had U.S. flags painted on them, as big or bigger than the flags on the Liberty. And they were using the most moderate identification, friend and foe, and they were being controlled by an AWACS aircraft, state of the art. And still, we killed 27. Lieutenant Wang, who was on the AWACS plane, was court-martialed for that event. And after a very short court-martial, he was acquitted. In time of war, terrible, terrible things happened. As you may recall, in this campaign, we shot down two of our own planes and one British tornado. Just a short time ago in Afghanistan, we killed a number of our Canadian friends for which they're still not happy with us.
Can I not let me say what they were shooting?
Well, I thought you just did.
Well, I was on the radio with the judge the other night. It would take a long time to tell you my experience.
Oh, we spent 2 hours on that program, didn't we?
Flies here. He had different experiences. We worked in different places on the ship. I can tell you that steadfastly, since the very beginning, the only group who has stuck to their story is the Liberty crew. The Liberty crew, for the most part, believed it was the Liberty, had steadfastly said that, and has facts about the attacks and things that were happening that make us believe so. For instance, you talk about shelling. Well, we had 450 caliber machine guns. Those machine guns were taken out on the very first flyover. They knew where the guns were when they attacked us, but they couldn't see our flag. I knew the flag was there. I saw the flag there.
But Mark, you read on the board out there, Captain McGonagall ordered the guns to fire at the Liberty, and he's on videotape explaining that he did make that order. But I would say this, that I had an interesting 2 hours with you. I'm willing to answer any more of your questions that you want to submit. And I think that this is where I believe I'm way over time.
Mr. Warren on Monday,
yeah,
who certainly believes that stated that he's the Israeli, who states that it was an accident. At the very end, he said, "Let's have an investigation." Stanford said, "Let's have an investigation." Would you be willing to say, "Let's have an investigation"?
I find no fault with having an investigation.
There has been none.
If you look at the press, you can see seven investigations scanned in an original form. If you look at them and you think that they're not adequate, then if somebody wants to do another one, the point is, it's 36 years later. Our present President Bush, in a letter dated October 2 of last year, said that he thought the investigations were signed by Christopher Lewin on his staff, one of the presidents, said that he thought that the investigations were adequate, and no further investigation was necessary. And then thereafter, Rumsfeld was questioned at a press conference, and he said to that question, "Well, it really is too late for additional investigations. Many people are deceased, and all the evidence is really here. It's really now a matter for the authorities." So, in any event, I have to concur with General Hodd as a closing remark. General Hodd, when I first approached him to talk about this, he said, "I don't want to talk about it." I said, "Why not?" He said, "The families and the survivors have suffered enough. I don't want to disturb an old wound." And so I said, "Well, General,
we still suffer."
And you do, and you have my sympathy and respect and honor. But I said, "General, let me tell you some of the stories are being told." And he listened, and he said, "Well, that's the greatest distortion of the truth. All right, I'll talk to you. I'll make the information available to you." And so I agree with General Hodge. If it gives any comfort to you to believe that it was an intentional attack, then accept that comfort and make your life easier. If you're a historian that wants to look at the facts, then look at all the facts. They're available. They're in my book. They're in my dissertation in the Library of Congress. They're on my website. They're in the State Department Guardian. And read all the facts and come to your own conclusion. And I hope that someday there'll be closure and peace, but some people say that it may never happen. But as I promised you, Mark, I personally have a copy of my book for you, and I hope when you read it, we'll get in touch, and I will try to answer any other questions that you may have. And I would say that anyone here should give a round of applause to the gallant crew of